Our next speaker is Dr. Dana Hayden. She's going to speak about colonic obstruction, what to do and when to do it. Dr. Hayden is a associate professor at Rush. She's also did her general surgery at Rush, as well as her colorectal surgery was actually done at the Cleveland Clinic in Florida. Without further ado, Dr. Hayden.
Thank you so much to the moderators and the audience for your attention and the privilege of the podium. I have no disclosures. So acute large bowel obstruction is considered a surgical emergency. About 85% are caused by a colorectal cancer. When colorectal cancers are first diagnosed, up to 15 to 20% may present with a large bowel obstruction. When we take patients to surgery as urgent or emergent, which is the standard of care, there is an associated high morbidity mortality with these procedures. Mortality can approach up to 50% following a surgery, and this is usually due to the associated advanced age of patients, frequent comorbidities, progressive stage of disease. There's also a high colostomy rate associated with emergent operations for LBOs, and this can be permanent up to 40% of patients. But relief of the obstruction is necessary, and this is due to either impending perforation, dehydration caused by massive fluid shifts, cardiovascular collapse, and death. So how do we choose the best treatment? Well, the first thing is just to decide how sick this patient is. Is the patient septic? Do they have peritonitis? Is this obstruction complete or partial? And then are there any risk factors associated with a high risk of complications, immune suppression, malnutrition, or multiple medical problems? We also want to know what the location of the lesion is. And then another important thing is, do you have proficient interventional GI or advanced endoscopy colleagues that have this training that can help us out if we're looking to avoid surgery? So for evaluation, if the patient is unstable or peritonitic, obviously, we're not wasting our time with a CT scan, but if they're not, you can get a CT scan. This can confirm the diagnosis in a majority of cases. This also can help with preoperative staging. Flexible endoscopy is also very useful. You can use carbon dioxide, and this allows for a rapid diagnosis and biopsy for distal tumors, and perforation is actually a pretty rare event. Water-soluble enemas are also useful. This can locate at the level of obstruction, and also can assess if this is a partial or complete obstruction. And biopsy should definitely be part of this workup. You can have a primary colorectal cancer, but it also could be a cancer that's erosive or extrinsically compressing the colon from an ovarian or endometrial tumor. So are there any non-surgical options? So we can consider endoscopic decompression in a rectal tube. If this patient is not peritonitic or unstable, you can try to decompress that proximal colon. It can lead to discomfort. Likely you need repeated interventions, and it's not usually definitive. There is some therapeutic endoscopy, like balloon dilation of a stricture, debulking of a large tumor, or laser photoablation. This can be helpful in high-risk patients that may be palliative, those that are refusing surgery. And again, specialists are necessary for this, and retreatment may be necessary. So in the 90s, self-expanding metal stents were first described. These are stents that are completely internalized. So what this allows for is acute decompression of the proximal colon. It can allow you then to bowel prep your patient and perform endoscopic evaluation for more proximal synchronous tumors. This can also lead to surgery or stoma avoidance in patients who have incurable malignant large bowel obstructions. Once these are deployed, obstructions should resolve either immediately over first few days. And again, when we're talking about these stents, they have to be considered if they're for palliative use or is it a bridge to surgery. So let's see if this video works. We're gonna jump ahead. So this is a colonic stricture. The endoscopist already passed the stent through, and now they're just pulling back the sheath to deploy the stent. So this should be happening pretty soon. And here we see the stent being deployed. There isn't necessarily going to be an immediate rush of stool or air, but these expand over a few days. So, of course, there are many risks associated with these stents. So technical failure, where we just couldn't open up the stent migration, regrowth, or perforation. Now, perforation is potentially catastrophic. If this was a localized tumor and you perforate, we're turning in a local problem to a widely disseminated problem. Delayed perforations can happen if someone has had a stent placed and they're on chemotherapy agents. And then there are also risks of increased risk of complications depending sometimes on the patient or the stricture. Higher complications may be associated with male sex, complete occlusions, and then inexperience of the interventionalist. So stents for palliation, this can be appropriate for inoperative cancers from either primary colorectal cancers or other malignancies and patients if they have a short life expectancy, about 6 months or less. These stents can reobstruct over time, however, they can be retreated. There's a study in 2015, about 80% of patients in the study were avoided a stoma. However, there was actually an associated high morbidity and mortality related to the stent placement. Other studies have showed high technical success rates with these stents with only moderate complications. And then there was a decreased number of patients in the study that required stoma placement. Another study looked at 100 consecutive patients. The median survival for these patients was 4 months. There was an initial technical success rate of almost 90% with low mortality. About 70 of 100 patients avoided a stoma, and about 70 patients avoided surgery in the study. So when we talk about stents as a bridge to surgery, the evidence is all over the place. So there's multiple small studies that use different definitions for large bowel obstructions. There's different definitions for severity of symptoms. There's been two randomized controlled trials that were that showed very low technical success rate and really no difference in stoma rates. Another randomized prospective study compared stents, then laparoscopic resection versus emergent surgery. The stents actually had good technical and clinical success, and they were able, in the majority of patients, to do a one-stage procedure. Other studies looked at stents as a bridge to surgery. In a prospective multinational series, there was a high technical and clinical success, and stents allowed for a resection plus primary anastomosis in almost 90% of patients. In a retrospective study looking at emergent surgery versus planned resection after stent or stoma, this study found that there was more lymph node yield when a patient had a stoma or stent followed by resection. There was longer length of stay and more operations when patients did have a stent and stoma. However, patients were able to get to adjuvant chemotherapy if they had a stent or stoma followed by resection. And then there was also higher 30-day mortality rates if the patient went to emergency surgery. So overall, we still have pretty terrible evidence when it comes to stents as a bridge to surgery. And European guidelines and the ASGE do not endorse stents unless it's for a poor surgical candidate or if we need to optimize them or they have an incurable cancer. However, expert opinion still supports use as a bridge to surgery, but it really is based on patients that are being seen at high volume centers when there's experts in interventional and our advanced endoscopy. So now your patient was either unstable or they had peritonitis. So what are we doing? We're going straight to the operating room. So our options for going straight to the operating room include either proximal diversion, a three-stage approach which would be diversion, followed by resection, followed by reversal, a Hartmann's procedure, a resection with a primary anastomosis, and finally a subtotal colectomy with a primary anastomosis. So again, the decision-making comes back to, is this a palliative or curative intent, the stability of the patient, the operative findings, and the patient's comorbidities. So talking about proximal diversion and comparing it to Hartmann's procedure, if the patient has metastatic disease or there's multi-organ involvement, they're septic or peritonitic, proximal diversion should be considered, and this can be a transverse loop colostomy or a cecostomy. This is okay for frail patients in the absence of perforation. It's very important to make sure you look at that cecum or right colon to make sure that it's not ischemic or has an impending perforation, so you're not leaving that in the patient. But if the colon looks viable, you can just pull up a colostomy. If the patient's unstable, you can do this. If there's diffuse carcinomatosis. Also, if there's a lot of barriers to healing, including severe malnutrition or immunocompromise. Loop ileostomy may not relieve this obstruction. If the patient has a competent ileocecal valve, you need to figure out how you're going to access that colon to decompress it. So just pulling up a loop may not be adequate. advantages of this, it's the surgery's faster, there's no risk of leak or staple line blowout. That gives you time for optimization and then maybe going on to chemotherapy. Also, if there's an inexperience of the surgical team at night, this is a safe procedure. Can you do this minimally invasively? You can use a laparoscopic approach, but it really depends how dilated that colon is, and again, the experience, and if there's no complete obstruction. So for right-sided lesions causing large bowel obstructions, it's really not that controversial. The treatment of choice is a right or extended right hemicolectomy with a primary anastomosis. Some studies did show higher anastomotic leak rates with this, although really those same studies didn't show a benefit of stenting or stoma at this time. And what's great about this is you're creating anastomosis between healthy small intestine and decompressed colon because you are distal to that obstruction. When surgery is not an option, stents have been used successfully in right-sided lesions. It's just not quite as easy as in left. Again, laparoscopy can be performed if the patient's stable, if the bowel is not overly dilated, and the surgeon has proficient skill. So for left-sided lesions, this is really where the questions lie. So a Hartmann's procedure is the most commonly performed surgery for malignant bowel obstructions. There are advantages for a Hartmann's procedure over a resection with primary anastomosis. It's a shorter time, there is no anastomosis. And for the distal stump, if you're worried about blowout, you can pull this up to the abdominal wall or create a mucous fistula. Disadvantages are that a lot of these Hartmann's reversals are not actually Hartmann's procedures are not actually reversed. This either is due to comorbidities or patients' wishes. It's technically challenging. There are high anastomotic leak rates and just the cost and overall supply of the reversal. So when we can do a resection with primary anastomosis, you at least want to consider this because it can be feasible. Historically, there's been showed that resection with anastomotic primary anastomosis did have high leak rates up to 20%. Some studies showed operative mortalities up to 8% with leak rates up to 6%. But then more recent studies did show that this can be safe and effective even without an on-table lavage. And then some studies went on to show that there was really equal leak rates and mortality comparing left-sided tumors to right-sided tumors. And again, this is when the proximal dilation isn't terrible. You can use on-table lavage, and you want to make sure that your patient is a good good risk for creating anastomosis. So resection with primary anastomosis with an intraoperative colonic lavage. You can do this if the patient's stable. It does allow for a single stage resection. It also allows for colonic decompression and resolution of this fecal load. There's methods that have been described, either performing an appendectomy and irrigating in antegrade fashion, or through a Y connector and then irrigating in retrograde fashion through the descending colon. Small studies did show primary anastomosis with really not a high rate of leak in a multi-centered randomized controlled trial. They compared a subtotal colectomy with segmental resection with on-table lavage. There was no difference in anastomotic leak rates. However, functional outcomes were actually found to be better in those that had segmental resection after on-table lavage. A more recent study looked at patients who underwent on-table lavage. Anastomotic leaks and wound infections were 5% and 3.5%, and really came out as to be the same as when they're controlled to compared to non-obstructed patients. In contrast, another study in 2011 looked comparing colonic stents with followed by segmental resection, or colonic stents followed by or performed after on-table lavage with segmental resection. This study was stopped due to a high anastomotic leak rate in those that underwent on-table lavage. Again, it's still controversial. Subtotal colectomy for left-sided bowel obstruction. Indications for this can be a cecal perforation or impending perforation, a synchronous proximal lesion that you're able to identify, a serosal injury to the cecum. If that cecum is overly descended, you can see these serosal tears that are forming, and this is something that I get very concerned about and would tend to choose a subtotal colectomy. And then it also helps to resolve this bowel size discrepancy. Again, you have small bowel that you're going to be attaching to the descending colon, or depending on the location, that's now decompressed because you're distal to that obstruction. A study looked at segmental resection with on-table lavage versus subtotal colectomy. It showed comparable morbidity mortality. Again, more frequent stools happen after a subtotal colectomy, is not surprising. A randomized control trial looked at 60 patients who underwent stent followed by colectomy versus total abdominal colectomy. Again, there was high success rates, minimal mortality or complications. There were increased post-op complications in the colectomy group. Recurrent disease was comparable, but again, for quality of life, there were more bowel movements that happened in these patients that underwent subtotal colectomy. So what to do and when? I don't know if I even helped with that, but it first depends on the exam. That's the most important thing. So if the patient is unstable or peritonitic, you're not getting a CT scan, you're not doing a flex dig, you are going to the operating room and performing surgery. If the patient is stable and non-peritonitic, you can consider decompression. Your GI colleague or your surgical colleague who has an advanced endoscopy skill can actually get you to better optimize the patient if you can resolve that acute obstruction with decompression, getting you ready to operate on the patient. Or if you go to the operating room, transverse loop colostomy, not an ileostomy if the patient's unstable and there's no evidence of frank perforation or ischemia. A subtotal colectomy with an ileorectal anastomosis or ileocolon anastomosis with, if the patient's stable, if there's ischemia or impending perforation of the cecum. A Hartmann's if the patient is not stable enough to perform a colonic lavage. If there's stool contamination pus or the colon just doesn't look healthy, do the resection, do not do the anastomosis, and just get out. Thank you so much for your attention.